If this is your first time joining us since our shutdown, I just want to welcome you and again let you know how good it is to see you. Our in-person midweek service resumed last Thursday with us going right into the heart of the book of Numbers. And the plan is to really finish what we started in our adult Sunday school. And so go ahead and turn with me, if you will, to the book of Numbers. Numbers chapter 22. Numbers chapter 22 is an unusual narrative, and I'm not going to read the whole thing before. We'll actually go through it together, but it is an unusual narrative. And it's an unusual narrative because it doesn't necessarily revolve around Moses or the people of Israel, but rather a prophet named Balaam, a Moabite king named Balak, and a talking donkey. And that's probably what makes this story unusual, because we have a talking donkey in the story. And it's really the only time in all the Bible that an animal speaks other than the serpent in the garden. And so what we have in Numbers chapter 22 is an unusual story. And we also have what appears on the surface a very confusing one. It's because a quick superficial read of the story will leave a person scratching his or her head as to whether Balaam is the hero or the villain in the story. Was he a prophet of God, or was he a false prophet, is the question we ask. Was this prophet a sinner, or was he a saint? Those are some questions that come to mind at first glance. Now, if we zoom in and focus the lenses a little, we'll find that the story comes to life with clarity. Now, there are three movements here in Numbers chapter 22, which I've titled, number one, the dilemma, number two, the deal, and lastly, of course, the donkey. Can never leave out the donkey. Well, we begin with the first movement here, the dilemma. The story begins in Numbers 22 with Balak, king of Moab, looking across his border in fear because of what he sees on the other side. He notices that the people of Israel have settled in the plains of Moab as his new neighbors. Look with me in verse 1 now. Then the people of Israel set out and camped in the plains of Moab beyond the Jordan at Jericho. And Balak the son of Zippor saw all that Israel had done to the Amorites. Now, there was reason for Balak to be afraid, because notice what Israel had just done prior to Numbers chapter 22. If you look with me in Numbers chapter 21, following the episode with the fiery serpents and the lifting up of the bronze serpent from last Thursday, notice Israel continued their advance into the promised land. And by the end of Numbers chapter 21, they defeated King Sihon and the Amorites. And they defeated King Og of Bashan. These were very swift and decisive victories. Israel, you could say, surprise, was on a two-game winning streak. And they were obliterating those in their path. Now imagine if you're Balak, king of Moab, looking through your binoculars, knowing all that had taken place with his Jewish army now camped just opposite of him. Balak was scared, and so were his people. Look with me in verse 3. And Moab was in great dread of the people, because there were many. Moab was overcome with fear of the people of Israel. And Moab said to the elders of Midian, "This horde will now lick up all that is around us as the ox licks up the grass of the field." Balak and the Moabites, they realized, we don't have a chance. That the percentage of us coming out of this alive is almost zero. And so what were they going to do? They saw that Israel's number outweighed theirs. They saw the dead Amorites on the ground. There was no prospect of victory. If they went into this conventional battle, if they went to hand-to-hand combat, they knew they were going to lose. So they decided that they needed a special weapon. A weapon, if you can say, of mass destruction. That's how they're going to win this war. They need a WMD. The Moabites needed a supernatural weapon if they were going to win this war. Well, what was this weapon? The weapon was a curse. The weapon was a curse. A curse from the gods that would give them the edge over Israel, that would give them the victory. That was the special weapon. And it was in search of this curse that Balak, he went looking for Balaam. Look at verse 4 in the middle. So Balak, the son of Zippor, who was king of Moab at that time, sent messengers to Balaam, the son of Beor, at Pethor, which is near the river, in the land of the people of Ammon, to call him, saying, behold, the people has come out of Egypt. They cover the face of the earth, and they are dwelling opposite of me. Come now, curse this people for me, since they are too mighty for me. Perhaps I shall be able to defeat them and drive them from the land. For I know that he whom you bless is blessed and he whom you curse is cursed. Now I want you to notice that of all the people, of all the resources, and of all the prophets even that Balak could turn to, he turned to Balaam. That tells us something about him. Balaam had a reputation. Balaam had 4 Yelp stars, if you want to say that, as a prophet. Balaam was the prophet to turn to in dealing with such a curse. And so notice Balak's reason for turning to Balaam. Look what he says there, I think. It's here at the end of verse 6. He says, for I know, that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed. I know this because I've heard about it. You have a reputation. You are an international prophet. Balaam was a man with international fame for dealing with such weaponry. But to hire a man of his standing will cost you. It will cost money, which is why Balak made sure to send his people with cash in hand. And it's here in the story that the dilemma now shifts to the deal. Look at verse 7. So the elders of Moab and the elders of Midian departed with the fees for divination in their hand. And they came to Balaam and gave him Balak's message. And he said to them, lodge here tonight, and I will bring back word to you as the Lord speaks to me. So the princes of Moab stayed with Balaam. And so with money in hand, this embassy of Moabites, they relay the king's message. We want you to curse Israel. And here's how Balaam responds. He tells them, go ahead, relax. Stop by that hotel, spend the night, because my answer depends on another. He tells them that I need to check with the Lord, and I need to see what he says to me. Now, at this point of the story, we might think to ourselves this. It appears that Balaam is a God-fearer, right? He's humbly submitting himself to God. And notice the name that he uses to refer to God. He uses the intimate and covenant name of God, Yahweh, which is indicated in our text with the all capital letters, Lord. He says, I need to check with Yahweh. But take a closer look. Balaam is not a part of the people of God who are camped inside the plains of Moab. Rather, verse 5 tells us that messengers were sent to Balaam, son of Beor, at Pethor. This was not a prophet among the people of God, a prophet residing within the confines of the camp of Israel, but at Pethor. In other words, Balaam was a pagan prophet. Well, how is it then that he speaks to God if he's a pagan prophet? And how is it that God speaks to him? Well, we shouldn't be surprised in the story. We shouldn't be so impressed, because if you know the story, God speaks through a donkey. So it doesn't really matter. It doesn't say much that God speaks through Balaam. It doesn't say much about him, because he speaks through a donkey. But Balaam tells the Moabites, spend the night while he takes the matter up to God to see if this is possible. Look at verse 9. And God came to Balaam and said, who are these men with you? The Lord appeared to Balaam in the night and he asked really one question. Who are these men with you? Now, why did the Lord ask that question? Did God, who is omniscient, not know who these men were? Of course he did. He certainly didn't need the information. But for you and I, as students of the Bible, we know that God often asks questions, doesn't he? Not for the benefit of himself, but rather for the benefit of his hearer. When he asked Adam in the garden, where are you? He was giving him an opportunity to confess his sins. When he asked Isaiah, whom shall I send? Who will go for us? He was giving Isaiah the opportunity to volunteer for the mission. So when the Lord asked Balaam, who are these men? He wasn't searching for the identity of the men, but he was pressing Balaam to realize who these men ultimately were and what little authority they had in his life. Who are these men, Balaam, that you should listen to them? Notice the exchange of words that follow verse 10. And Balaam said to God, Balak the son of Zippor, king of Moab, has sent to me, saying, behold, the people has come out of Egypt, and it covers the face of the earth. Now come, curse them for me. Perhaps I shall be able to fight against them and drive them out. God said to Balaam, you shall not go with them. You shall not curse the people, for they are blessed. Now notice when Balaam takes the request to God that he leaves a lot of details out. One important detail is that he's about to be handsomely paid for his services. He doesn't say that to God. You know, a way that you can know, if you didn't know already, that you're up to no good is if someone asks you and you leave a lot of important details out, right? There have been a few occasions during this time of COVID that I'll take the car keys and I'll be on my way out of the house and Deb will ask me, where are you going? And that's the tone. And I'll say, out. Out where? Somewhere. Where is that somewhere? And there's no way around it. So I'll have to come clean and I'll just tell her, I'm going to get a pie at Marie Callender's. That's what I'm doing. And the reason why I was leaving all the details out is because I'm a little ashamed. Because I've done it like 4 times now during this whole COVID time. Because I really want a pie. I want a pie. But leaving out the details says something. And it said something about Balaam. Notice another important detail that he leaves out. And it's this. He fails to mention to God what the Moabite king said about him. Because what the Moabite king said about Balaam was this: "For I know that he whom you bless is blessed, and he whom you curse is cursed." You see, in Balak's eyes, Balaam is the man. But Balaam, I think he knows better. And he knows that's not how it operates. And so he leaves that detail out. But he still brings the matter to God. And God's response, as we read, God says, "No, you can't go with them. You can't go with them because you can't curse them. They are my people and they are blessed. You can't go with them and you can't curse them." The answer is no, Balaam. Look at verse 13. "So Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak, 'Go to your own land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you.' So the princes of Moab rose and went to Balak and said, 'Balaam refuses to come with us.'" Balaam relays the message to the Moabite men, to the princes. But think with me here. Is Balaam now succumbing to God's will here? Again, listen not to what Balaam says, but to what he doesn't say. And you can hear it loudly from the sounds of silence from Balaam. He tells the men, "Go to your land, for," or "because," "go to your land because the Lord has refused to let me go with you. Because the Lord won't let me go." Notice that there is no mention of the real reason as to why God told them that he couldn't go. The Lord said, "You shall not curse them, Balaam." Why? Because they are blessed. This was the Lord's will. This was God's decree. Yet Balaam doesn't say that. He also doesn't show any kind of hesitation or reluctance to fulfill their request. In other words, he gives the impression that he would very much like to go, but God is not letting him go. That he would very much like to go, but is forbidden to go. You know, when Cammie tells her little friends that she can't play with them yet because she didn't finish her dinner, she'll communicate it in a way that she would very much like to play with her little friends, but is being presently detained against her will. That's how they say it, right? And so too Balaam, when he says that the Lord had refused to let him go, he is clearly implying that he would have personally loved to go and fulfill Balak's request if only the circumstances were different. Now you see then. You see then what is taking place in the chambers of Balaam's heart. What is revealed is a tension taking place in the inside. The demands of Balak and his reward on the one hand and the commands of God on the other. Look at verse 15. "Once again, Balak sent princes more in number and more honorable than these. And they came to Balaam and said to him, 'Thus says Balak, the son of Zippor, let nothing hinder you from coming to me. For I will surely do you great honor. And whatever you say to me, I will do. Come, curse this people for me.' But Balaam answered and said to the servants of Balak, 'Though Balak were to give me his house full of silver and gold, I could not go beyond the command of the Lord my God to do less or more.'" Well, what does a king do when his initial offer is rejected? You come with a higher offer, and that's what he does. Balak comes with a more enticing offer and with a more esteemed group. Now, on the face of it, Balaam, he sounds very spiritual. Though Balak were to give me a house full of silver or gold, I could not go beyond the command of the Lord, my God, to do less or more. What a noble and self-sacrificial position. And again we ask, has Balaam changed his ways? Look at verse 19. So you too, this is Balaam talking to the men, please stay here tonight that I may know what more the Lord will say to me. You see, if Balaam really meant the words that he spoke about not doing anything great or small beyond the command of the Lord, then the narrative would have ended right there. Numbers chapter 22 would have ended at verse 18. But what does he do? What does he do despite the words that he just spoke? He invites the princes of Moab to stay the night so that he can again ask the Lord. Balaam here suffers from selective hearing, and many of us suffer from that condition. What part of "you shall not go with them" did Balaam not understand? Inviting the men to stay the night tells us that Balaam's heart wasn't fully set on obeying God. Why? It's because he wanted his bounty. You see, for all his wonderful words, Balaam couldn't let the prospect of Balak's gold escape without a fight. Look at verse 20. And God came to Balaam at night and said to him, if the men have come to call you, rise, go with them, but only do what I tell you. So Balaam rose in the morning and saddled his donkey and went with the princes of Moab. Now, is God changing his mind and all of a sudden telling Balaam, okay, I get it. It's a lot of money. You can go. Is that what God is saying here? What is God doing? Did God finally succumb to Balaam? The NIV, if you have the NIV translation, it says here, since these men have come to summon you, you go with them. Since these men. But I think the NASB and the ESV gives us a better translation, which says, if the men have come to call you, rise, go with them. Well, what's the difference? I want you to notice here, God is not directly commanding Balaam to go to Moab with the men. Rather, he gives a condition. If these men have come to call you, if these men have come to call you, the focus is on these men. It was the same question that he asked Balaam before. Remember? Who are these men? That is, what authority do these men have to summon you? What sway, what influence do these men have to tell you what to do? What God is saying here to Balaam is this. If the summons of men and the glory of their reward is really that important to you, so important that it outweighs the command of God, then go. Then go with them. You see, Balaam had to make a decision. Whether to go with the men and follow his idolatry or stay back with the Lord. Well, what does he do? He goes with them. And notice back, look back in verse 13. Balaam was in this situation before. After the Lord spoke to him for the first time, it says there in verse 13, Balaam rose in the morning and said to the princes of Balak go to your own land, for the Lord has refused to let me go with you. Now on this second occasion in verse 21, after the Lord speaks to him, notice it opens the very same way that Balaam rose in the morning. But notice this time, he doesn't say a word to the men. This time he doesn't say a word to the men as to what God said. He didn't say, look, I'll go with you, but I can only say what God says. It says that he simply saddled his donkey and went with them. And he goes with them in haste. And so it's easy to see then in verse 22 as to why God's anger was kindled against Balaam. It's because he went. You know, when we take a step back and analyze the narrative, the deal is not so much a deal to get Balaam to curse Israel, but a deal to get Balaam's heart. And here's the thing for you and I. Those deals take place multiple times a day in our own hearts. The challenge that this story puts before us is this. Where does your heart lie? Faced with the choice between obeying the command of God and pursuing Balak's silver and gold, the silver and gold triumphed in Balaam's heart. And notice how it did. By slow influence. You notice that? In the story, by steady sway, you can just watch Balaam's heart. There was a gradual movement towards the idol. And Christian, we have to ask ourselves, are we so different than Balaam? Christian, do you know that there is a war that's raging in your soul? John Owen said it in very gripping words. He said, be killing sin or it will be killing you. That there's nothing neutral going on in your heart. That there is a competition taking place in your heart, and the question is, who's winning? You know, this evening, as you evaluate the inner recesses of your heart and your mind, what has your attention? What has your attention? Is there something that is gradually bringing you under its influence? What in your life is slowly, and I say slowly and steadily, spiritually harming you and not helping you? And I say slowly. That has you pointing towards a trajectory of worldliness over against holiness. Disobedience over against obedience. You know, if we really want to know what drives us, it's important to recognize that the answer is often more evident in our actions than in our words. You know, just as Balaam's attempt to get a different response out of God exposed his divided heart and betrayed the emptiness of his words, so too, often with ourselves, our words and our actions, they are often at odds, aren't they? They are. We can piously commit to the Lord by mouth before a certain group of people on certain days of the week, but our actions can reveal an altogether different master. You see, our actions make plain what else we must have apart from the Lord to make our lives feel meaningful and significant. Our actions will show us that. And beloved, that's called an idol. You ever ask yourself that? Like, what do I need? What do I need right now that will make my life feel meaningful and significant? What do I need apart from the Lord? There's a lot of things. I sent a quote in the members' email, I think this week, from John Calvin, who said, "Every one of us, even from his mother's womb, is a master craftsman of idols." And beloved, that is so true. And Calvin was able to say that because he knew his own heart. And it's for the idol of his heart that Balaam departed with the Moabite men. As we move on now to the last segment of the story, which is the donkey. Look with me in verse 22, and I'm going to read all the way through 35, but I want you to follow along in this incredible story. "But God's anger was kindled because he went, and the angel of the Lord took his stand in the way as his adversary. Now he was riding on the donkey, and his two servants were with him. And the donkey saw the angel of the Lord standing in the road with a drawn sword in his hand. And the donkey turned aside out of the road and went into the field. And Balaam struck the donkey to turn her into the road. Then the angel of the Lord stood in a narrow path between the vineyards with a wall on either side. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she pushed against the wall and pressed Balaam's foot against the wall. So he struck her again. Then the angel of the Lord went ahead and stood in a narrow place where there was no way to turn either to the right or to the left. And when the donkey saw the angel of the Lord, she lay down under Balaam. And Balaam's anger was kindled. And he struck the donkey with his staff. Then the Lord opened the mouth of the donkey. And she said to Balaam, 'What have I done to you that you have struck me these three times?' And Balaam said to the donkey, 'Because you have made a fool of me. I wish I had a sword in my hand, for then I would kill you.' And the donkey said to Balaam, 'Am I not your donkey on which you have ridden all your life long to this day? Is it my habit to treat you this way?' And he said, 'No.' Then the Lord opened the eyes of Balaam, and he saw the angel of the Lord standing in the way with his drawn sword in his hand. And he bowed down and fell on his face. And the angel of the Lord said to him, 'Why have you struck your donkey these three times? Behold, I have come out to oppose you, because your way is perverse before me.' The donkey saw me and turned aside before me these three times. If she had not turned aside from me, surely just now I would have killed you and let her live. Then Balaam said to the angel of the Lord, 'I have sinned, for I did not know that you stood in the road against me. Now therefore, if it is evil in your sight, I will turn back.' And the angel of the Lord said to Balaam, 'Go with the men, but speak only the word that I tell you.' So Balaam went on with the princes of Balak." This is a remarkable story. Three times the donkey stops as it sees the angel of the Lord. And three times Balaam, he strikes his donkey, failing to see what's before him until God speaks to him from the donkey's mouth. Can you imagine if you're riding a donkey, like, "Go, you stupid donkey, go." And all of a sudden the donkey's like, "Stop that, man." You're like, "Oh my gosh, what is going on?" That's exactly what happened here. The donkey spoke to Balaam, telling him of the error of his ways. Now, there are a few things that I want to point out to you here. And first, and it's very obvious when you read the story, What's stressed to us here is the blindness of Balaam, right? Think about who Balaam was. He was a professional prophet. He made his living discerning messages from God that others were not able to hear or see. Yet here he is, unable. He can't even see the angel of the Lord that's standing in plain sight in front of him. Right in front of him. Here is this renowned prophet that cannot see what the dumb donkey, this animal, can clearly see. Why was this the case? It's because of his corrupted heart that he wasn't able to see the messenger of God before him. You know what that teaches you and I? You see, that principle holds true for us as well, doesn't it? It's that a heart that is divided, a heart that is filled with anything other than God, that a heart that is filled with sin and worldliness cannot see. It cannot see. That it lacks the ability to see with clarity God. Why should I, as a Christian, be afraid of any idol or influence in my life apart from God? It's because, you see, it will hinder and fog my vision of Him. That's why we should be afraid. I want the blessedness of Christ when He said, "Blessed are the pure in heart." Why? Why will they be blessed? For they shall see God. And so again, we find here the blindness of Balaam. Why? Because of the corruption of his heart. Again, it tells us, brothers and sisters, when we are in sin, we are not thinking. When we are in sin, we are not thinking right because we cannot see God. Second, I want you to notice that Balaam was a hired prophet. Hired to travel a great distance to curse an entire nation. That's not a small task, right? Here are the Moabites. Okay, we need to go hire a specialist who can curse this entire nation of 2 million people. And that was Balaam. He was a hired prophet, hired to curse an entire nation with the mere words from his mouth. That's all he needed. He didn't need a lot of equipment with him. He just needed his mouth. But yet what we find in the story is this. He couldn't even curse a donkey. He couldn't even curse the animal. Balaam, whose mission was to bring down all of Israel with his mere words with a curse, was so impotent that his little donkey made him look foolish. So much that he was reduced to beating the poor animal, shouting empty threats at it. I mean, if you were watching this from afar, you could just see Balaam, this renowned world prophet, and he's kicking this animal. "Go, you donkey, go." He's like beating this animal. And you can just see the humor. You can just see the humor in the story. The world famous prophet, he had absolute zero power. And there's so much irony to the story. From the mouth of Balaam came lies, while from the mouth of the donkey came truth. Balaam was the prophet who was supposed to have divine insight from the gods, from above, yet he was no wiser than an animal. But I think the picture that really grabs our attention is this. is Balaam kicking his donkey and telling his donkey that he wished that he had a sword in his hand to kill the donkey because of its disobedience. All the while before him stood the angel of the Lord with a sword drawn in his hand, ready to destroy Balaam. Isn't that crazy? This is an incredible story, but one that should teach us, one that should teach us that the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of men. That our holy and sovereign and all-wise God is able to take the best of the world's men and reduce them even lower than a donkey. I feel like if I would have used the other word for a donkey, y'all would have been too shocked, but I think it would have really driven home the point. Oh, the depth of the riches and wisdom and knowledge of God. How unsearchable are his judgments. How inscrutable his ways. The last thing I want to point out to you, and we'll close with this, is if you take a step back from Numbers chapter 22, you'll realize that, yes, Israel has been mentioned in this story, but they're not in the story, right? They're not in the story. Did you notice that? They have no active role in the narrative. In other words, when Numbers 22 is taking place in real time, Israel, they have no idea. They're on the other side. And they're camped out. And they're probably singing and dancing because they just defeated some of those armies and they're on a two-game winning streak. And they're just doing their own thing. But they have no idea what's going on. They are oblivious to Balaam and to Balak's request to curse them. They don't know. They're on the other side. With not the slightest clue. And so why then? Why then did God tell Moses to write this story into the book of Numbers? Think about that. If they're not even in the story. Why does Israel need to know this story about a pagan prophet, a Moabite king, and a talking donkey? It was to show Israel that no matter how much the opposition wanted to curse them, that the Lord their God would bless them. That is amazing. They had no clue. They had no idea. God tells Moses to put this story into Numbers chapter 22 to show them that he would never forsake his promise to them. Remember what God told Abraham in Genesis chapter 12. Abraham, I will bless you. I will make your name great, and I will bless you. And God said, and I will bless those who bless you, and him who dishonors you, I will curse. It was God keeping his promise to his people, even when they had no idea. Beloved, the same thing happens in our own Christian lives. How God continues to keep his promise to us. How many times, if you imagine in your own life, has God protected you from something where you had no idea? By shielding you from any kind of curse that could befall you. You know, for us as Christians, we know what that's like. We know what that's like to be shielded from a curse. A curse for which we justly deserve. The curse of sin. Yet the cross of Jesus Christ is the surety of the Lord's unshakable will to bless his people. That's what the cross is. Because on the cross, he gave his son, and it says there in Galatians 3:13 that Christ redeemed us from the curse of the law by becoming a curse for us. As it is written, cursed is everyone who is hanged on a tree. You see, at the end of the day, for us as Christians, we deserve to be cursed. Well, why was Jesus cursed? And it's very simple. The answer is so that you might be blessed. Jesus was cursed that you might be blessed with the blessing of salvation and the forgiveness of sins. Let's pray together. Loving Father, as we have been exposed to the light of your soul-searching word, may your Holy Spirit impress upon us just an all-consuming desire to be possessed by Christ and only Christ. That Christ would garner our full and undivided attention. That our hearts would be held captive by nothing else but Christ. We ask that you would help us to taste and see that the Lord is good, better than what this world could offer. And so our prayer is not only that you would give us Jesus, but that our heart's desire would be to want only Jesus. In whose holy and sweet name we pray. Amen.